Bill de Blasio centered his mayoral campaign message on the notion of New York as a tale of two cities, home to nearly 400,000 millionaires, while half the city's population lives at or near the poverty line. Where can they find a place to live? Well, and how much affordable housing is available in the city? In an article in last week's New York Observer, staff writer Chris Pomarski looked into whether residential or mixed-use real estate developers have an obligation to ensure a certain percentage of apartments are deemed as affordable, that is, to be available below market rates. He also compares the approaches of Michael Bloomberg with our new mayors and what they mean for current mega real estate developments like Hudson Yards in Manhattan and Atlantic Yards in Brooklyn, as well as for future developments. And I'm very pleased to welcome Chris Pomarski to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
People have said to me over the past decade that Manhattan is only for the rich and ask who can afford to live there. And I've even heard people say the commute from Philadelphia is really not all that bad. Well, but New York City is a huge place. Why has affordable housing become so scarce?
Well, housing is scarce as a general rule. There's also a significant market rate shortage. And given that incomes in Manhattan, especially now, are so high, that leads to the market rate units available being very expensive, and naturally that boxes people out.
What is the current median rate for a two-bedroom apartment in Manhattan?
Rent? I'm not sure. I know that an average new development condo will run you about $2.69 million now.
Really?
That's a new apartment.
Well, but rents are also sky high. But a two-bedroom is $2.5 million, you're saying. Is this problem only in Manhattan?
No, of course. It's spread to Brooklyn, as I'm sure people have heard, especially in Park Slope, which has long been expensive, Brooklyn Heights, Williamsburg, these sorts of enclaves just outside of Manhattan, and which share sort of similar sensibilities.
And now moving into Long Island City, but not the Bronx and Staten Island. They have been spared this so far?
More so than in Brooklyn, for sure.
Why should real estate developers be beholden to these New Yorkers who can't afford the going rate if that's what the market will bear?
That's a good question. More or less everyone I spoke with in connection with this piece, even market rate developers, will say that because they are the ones doing the building and we need all different kinds of people to make the city function, that it does fall to them, that responsibility. And also there's the fact that an awful lot of what they're selling is simply a seat at something very large.
You call that the poetic defense?
That's the poetic defense, yes.
But some people have said that the fact that the city has become unaffordable to many is actually a sign of progress. It's kind of a good problem. How did they make that argument?
I'm not sure. I don't totally understand the logic of that argument. You can understand what that individual was saying. Manhattan has seen sort of a great renaissance in the last 15 years or so. But I think we still need to make sure that there's a place for everyone here.
But Michael Bloomberg said, send us your billionaires. That was kind of part of this argument, that the more rich people we have in the city, the better it is for the tax rolls and theoretically for everyone else, if you believe in the trickle-down theory.
There is something to that argument, although an awful lot of foreign investors who are buying these super expensive apartments don't ultimately spend that much time in the city, and that decreases the extent to which they contribute to the tax base.
Historically, what types of programs has the city promoted to ensure that people of all incomes can live and work here? Is it housing projects? What's the current status of Mitchell Llama housing?
Many of those units are about to age out of affordability. So about two-thirds of the units that Bloomberg was able to create or preserve were indeed preservations. So ensuring that units like Mitchell Llama housing did not expire in their affordability.
But we're not building any more Mitchell Llama houses?
Not at the moment. But to answer the broader question, I mean, there are literally dozens and dozens of programs that have been applied since the Depression, and they run the gamut.
What types of incentives did the Bloomberg administration offer developers in exchange for including affordable units in their projects?
There's this policy called inclusionary housing. It's not original to Bloomberg. It's been used elsewhere. So in New York, under Bloomberg, in neighborhoods like Williamsburg or Midtown West that were rezoned from industrial purpose to be eligible for residential uses, developers would get a density bonus for agreeing to include 20% of floor area in those buildings at sort of a submarket rate.
And once those deals were made and the incentives provided, what mechanisms were in place to regulate and enforce those agreements? Do we know whether that those full percentages are being taken advantage of?
Well, it doesn't look like they were. There's a report by Councilman Lander in August that indicated that a significant percentage that ought to have shown up as a result of some of these inclusionary efforts just never arrived. So it looks like whatever de Blasio's new policy is, it will need to be much more strictly regulated.
The main example you cite in your article is the Hudson Yards development on Manhattan's far west side, and you describe it as an area designed to incorporate inequality.
In the sense that it was imagined as the mixed income as well as a mixed use development. So the idea being not to warehouse lower income folks sort of in a separate part of the city, but to have everybody sort of coexisting and working together.
And what percentage of residential units to be built in the Hudson Yards area will be priced below the market rate?
In theory, about a quarter, just under 25%.
Community Board 4, whose purview includes Hudson Yards, raised concerns about that idea. What problems did they have with the proposal?
Specifically, this regarded a development called Silver Towers, which is basically two very large, luxurious rental buildings. And the developer, Silverstein Properties, requested and got a density bonus for including an additional, basically an affordable garage at the back of one of these buildings. And the community board's objections were to the fact that they were sort of much less nice than the market rate units. They do indeed look onto the back of a bus station.
So this is some people are saying this is a matter of separate but equal?
Yes. I think it puts a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths.
Are the units that that are below market rate similar to the units that are at market rate?
They tend to be a lot smaller. Often sub-market rate unit tenants don't have access to building amenities. There are instances where there are separate entrances. So it varies. But the biggest problem, I would say, is size. They tend to be very small.
But separate entrances, that kind of almost suggests the segregated South, whites only, blacks only.
Well, I don't know if I'd go that far, but it certainly doesn't look great to a lot of people when that situation occurs.
My guest is Chris Pomarski. His article is Manhattan for Everyone, the Pied à Terre and the Poor Door. It was in the New York Observer's February 19th issue. The New York Post ran an article about a residential housing development at 40 Riverside Boulevard in the Upper West Side that included those, the rich entrance and the poor entrance. That did create an uproar. People are questioning the whole matter of this kind of design because they say it tells a deep truth.
There were certainly people who were very upset, Christine Quinn among them. But I guess sort of the question is whether or not these kinds of arrangements really undermine the larger goals of creating affordable housing in buildings that are otherwise sort of very fancy.
Well, it's my sense that the suggestion here is we don't want the wealthy people who are paying top dollar to have to mingle with the hoi polloi who are getting the less expensive apartments.
That seems to be an implication, yeah. But ultimately, people in Manhattan and everywhere really are self-segregating along economic lines all the time, so...
Yeah, well, we don't have a lot of poor people living on Park Avenue.
For example.
How successful in your mind was Bloomberg's opt-in program to include affordable housing in new development projects?
Well, in terms of sheer number of units he created, it was quite successful. Pretty much everyone across the board will say that, even those who feel that he was much too generous to developers. 165,000 units is quite a few. But where the program seemed to have fallen a bit short was in his reluctance to ask that developers by necessity create affordable units in new developments.
A caller asks if you believe that recent New York City mayors have been pro-business, pro-real estate, and that that's played a big role in the lack of affordable housing.
I'm not sure if I'm qualified to answer that question, but I think ultimately building a lot and having a pro-real estate stance does not necessarily mean a lack of affordable housing.
In your article, Vishan Chakrabarty, who's the director of Columbia University's Center for Urban Real Estate, questions whether we've been too focused on Manhattan's high-density luxury buildings to the exclusion of opportunities in other boroughs.
Right. And his solutions, to a great extent, correspond to a general population influx in New York, which suggests that, affordable or not, a lot of people are going to have to live somewhere other than downtown Manhattan.
Yeah, but now, as you mentioned, there's been new construction in Williamsburg and Greenpoint, and we're seeing the same kinds of problems, aren't we? And then in other neighborhoods where there isn't new construction, like Bed-Stuy and Harlem, we are also seeing gentrification drive up rents of older buildings.
Sure.
So is there any place that you could still get, if you're living near the poverty line, there are a lot of people in the city who do, is there any place that they can live in that isn't going to eat up most of their income?
That is problematic. One of the issues I think that Bloomberg also maybe didn't address adequately was that an awful lot of quote-unquote affordable units that were created, functionally speaking, were really for the middle class or even the upper middle class.
So what does affordable mean? And those are rentals, I assume.
Yes.
And what does affordable mean in those circumstances?
So these calculations are all based on average median income, which last year in New York was $85,900, I believe, for a family of four. So an awful lot of these units, two-thirds, were affordable only to people who are making more than 50% of the AMI. And housing advocates say that that really has a negative effect on people on the lower rungs who, as I'm sure you've heard, sort of increasingly ending up in the shelter system.
Or in the far reaches, the far corners of the city, the areas that are poorly served by public transportation or are still run down because gentrification hasn't hit them yet.
Sure.
Hasn't there been resistance to the outer boroughs to the development of large-scale developments? I'm thinking about Atlantic Yards in Brooklyn, although it had the support of the Brooklyn Borough President at the time, the mayor, some people who represented the area. The only reason it's been scaled back is because of economic issues, not because anybody in government tried to change things.
True, but there have been a lot of delays and legal issues, as I'm sure you've heard, and there's sort of a continued local uproar about Atlantic Yards, I think, and that was part of Mr. Chakrabarty's thesis that in sort of outlying neighborhoods that don't have these entrenched community boards, this sort of brownstone Brooklyn sense of a historical neighborhood, it might be easier to create these very large scale mixed income developments, but it remains to be seen how those communities will react naturally.
Of course, Columbia is involved in its own dispute over some low rental areas around Columbia that Columbia is taking over to expand as a university.
Sure.
So it has its own dog in this contest.
Sure.
In the aftermath of Bill de Blasio's mayoral campaign theme that there are now two New Yorks, one for the haves and one for the have-nots. Has he made any specific proposals to ensure that affordable housing units are part of any new residential developments before ground is broken?
Yes, that was sort of the central pillar of a many-faceted affordable housing plan, changing the Bloomberg policy of sort of voluntarily including affordable units in new developments in rezoned neighborhoods to make that a requirement. And real estate developers sort of were a bit wary about this early on. It sounds almost like punishment to certain years, but it seems as though those tensions are easing. I know he spoke to the Real Estate Board of New York last week, reputedly to a great deal of applause. So,
but basically what he's saying is that we should make inclusion of affordable housing mandatory in any new residential construction?
Correct. He's not suggesting to withdraw the density bonuses, though. So developers will still stand to benefit from these kinds of bonuses, which will enable them to include more market rate units in each building.
In addition to including affordable housing units in building plans, what other programs have been proposed or implemented to help ensure the population of Manhattan and other boroughs are made up of mixed incomes?
As I mentioned, there are literally dozens of programs. One that people may have heard a good deal about is this 421A tax incentive, which is a partial real estate tax exemption for new construction of multifamily homes. And they require that 20% of units are available to very low-income households.
What is the New York Housing Trust Fund?
I'm sorry?
The New York Housing Trust Fund?
That was associated with Battery Park City. So I believe that was founded in 2006 with $130 million in funding from the Battery Park City development. And that was used to rehabilitate housing elsewhere in the city.
Because there's no low-income housing in Battery Park City that I can see.
There's no affordable housing there, no.
Yeah. Other people have been writing in about the fact that there are a number of stories about wealthy people buying entire buildings which used to hold multiple apartments and then converting them into single-family dwellings.
Mm-hmm.
The SROs pretty much have disappeared in New York. They were a mixed bag, but still it means that people then have to find other places to live. Is density changing? Are density patterns changing in the city?
Absolutely. I mean, there's been a lot of discussion about the increasing height of skyscrapers, and that looks likely to continue, that trend. De Blasio has sort of said explicitly that he's interested in building very big if it means that will create a lot of affordable housing.
There are other people who object to the idea of building big. Williamsburg has a whole bunch of cookie-cutter buildings that have been going up. They are architecturally actually have no distinction whatsoever.
Right.
And people hate it. It's actually changing the quality of some neighborhoods in New York from having a certain amount of historic quaintness to looking just like they could be in Dallas, or I know I'm going to get angry mail from somebody from Texas, but any of a number of other cities where all the housing looks the same.
Sure. I'm not sure if I'm best positioned to propose a solution to that, but it is certainly a sticking point, and the Landmarks Commission is not thrilled about it either.
Another someone has written in wondering why the city is focused on so much waterfront development.
That may be because those are areas that were previously zoned industrial, as in Williamsburg, and areas that sort of offer a good deal of space for these kinds of large-scale developments.
A caller says, I don't know if it's he or she, lives around the corner from 40 Riverside Boulevard and spoke to the engineer there and was told that the affordable units were all around the air conditioning units where no one would want them. Plus, folks like Patti LaBelle and Alex Rodriguez, who are living there, aren't paying real estate taxes.
I don't know the specifics of that situation, but that may be related to an abatement that the developer received for the building. But nobody is living in that building now because it's not completed, 40 Riverside Boulevard.
Time Warner announced last month that it's going to move in late 2018 from its headquarters at Columbus Circle to a new 80-story building to be built on 10th Avenue and 33rd Street. What impact will that move have on Hudson Yards and its affordability?
I'm not sure. I haven't heard about that, but it sounds like it's a part of the overall change in that part of town.
I was thinking about the complaints that people have now in San Francisco about how Silicon Valley has made a lot of the housing unaffordable because the people with money have now taken over neighborhoods and they're being forced out. And I'm assuming that similar things are going to happen when people want to work near their offices.
Yes, I think a lot of people are moving to Oakland from San Francisco, who formerly could afford the Mission District, maybe. But San Francisco is a city that has seen sort of mixed results with a mandatory inclusionary policy, actually. But there's not a whole lot of evidence to suggest that that's a comparable plan to what the new mayor will implement or whether it will be similarly successful.
Well, what do you see when you look at other cities in the United States? Have any of them done a particularly good job in incorporating affordable housing into large-scale luxury building developments?
I don't know specifically if they've done it that way. These programs vary a lot from place to place based on demographics, needs, local trends. Montgomery County, Maryland is actually a place that has seen effective implementation of this kind of a policy.
Is that near Washington, D.C.?
Yes. So they seem to have done it by being very specific about their goals in terms of which segments of the population they were trying to reach with which projects, and also updating and reevaluating the data sort of very frequently to make sure they continue to be in line.
Well, in New York in the past, when certain proposals were made, we heard the big NIMBY complaint. Yes, I want to see affordable housing for those people, but not in my backyard.
Right.
Is that still an issue?
I think it is. I think that was a big part of the brouhaha with Atlantic Yards, that New York, you have a lot of theoretically progressive people, but they also have their lifestyle and they would rather not have it interrupted.
But there were a lot of other complaints about Atlantic Yards. The architects complained about just the look of the project, the fact that streets would be cut off, that there would be parks within the project, but they would not be available to anyone who didn't live in those buildings. There were all sorts of issues that went way beyond whether there were going to be a bunch of high-rises in the middle of Brooklyn. There was even just the matter of whether we were going to be able to see the Williamsburg Savings Bank clock if some of those buildings went up.
Sure. All legitimate concerns, but I think that inevitably hard decisions are ahead, and it may turn out that something like a view of the clock is quaint by comparison to what needs to get done.
Well, in the past, New York had a lot of manufacturing. It had all sorts of jobs that are no longer here, and that was a reason that you wanted to have people of a wide economic range living in the city. Now the city, the jobs here are a little different. Do you think that will affect the way that it's going to be, it will look in 25 years from now?
I'm sure it will. I mean, the ascendancy of sort of the financial industry and attendant legal services, et cetera, I can't imagine that won't cause the face of the city to continue to change.
And Manhattan, it will probably be a borough only for the people who can afford to buy expensive condos, apartments, or pay high rents.
Well, I don't.
I mean, that's what's happened in London.
Yes,
the center of town.
That's true. But New York continues to be a lot more diverse than London in terms of the industry here. So I think the new mayor would definitely not like to see that happen.
Do you think it's one of the reasons that Bill de Blasio won by such a huge landslide? People are a bit concerned about how the face of the city is changing, or this sense of a city for the wealthy and another city for the poor.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for being on our show. Chris Pomarski's article is Manhattan for Everyone, The Pied-à-Terre and the Poor Door is in the New York Observer's February 19th issue.